To Genesis, chapter 19, verses 12 through 14, the angels told Lot to take his wife, sons, daughters, sons-in-law, and daughters-in-law out of the town with all speed, for they warned him it would be destroyed very soon. The family was unwilling to believe this strange warning and took the whole thing for one of Father Lot's bad jokes. And Genesis continues, "And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him. And they brought him forth, and set him without the city. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, Escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou be come thither." According to this report, there is no doubt that the two strangers, the angels, possessed a power unknown to the inhabitants. The suggestive urgency, the speed with which they drove the Lot family on, also makes us think. When Father Lot tarried, they pulled him along by the hands. They had to get away in a matter of minutes. Lot, they ordered, must go into the mountains, and he must not turn around. Nevertheless, Lot does not seem to have had unlimited respect for the angels, because he keeps on making objections. "I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die." A little later, the angels say that they cannot do anything for him if he does not go with them. What actually happened at Sodom? We cannot imagine that Almighty God is tied down to a timetable. Then why were his angels in such a hurry? Or was the destruction of the city by some power or other fixed to the very minute? Had the countdown already begun, and did the angels know about it? In that case, the moment of destruction would obviously have been imminent. Was there no simpler method of bringing the Lot family to safety? Why did they have to go into the mountains at all costs? And why on earth should they be forbidden to look around again? Admittedly, these are awkward questions about a serious matter, but since the dropping of two atomic bombs on Japan, we know the kind of damage such bombs cause and that living creatures exposed to direct radiation die or become incurably ill. Let us imagine for a moment that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed according to plan, that is, deliberately, by a nuclear explosion. Perhaps, let us speculate a little further, the angels simply wanted to destroy some dangerous fissionable material and at the same time to make sure of wiping out a human brood they found unpleasant. The time for the destruction was fixed. Those who were to escape it, such as the Lot family, had to stay a few miles from the center of the explosion in the mountains, for the rock faces would naturally absorb the powerful dangerous rays. And, we all know the story, Lot's wife turned around and looked straight at the atomic sun. Nowadays, no one is surprised that she fell dead on the spot. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire. And this is how the account of the catastrophe ends, Genesis chapter 19, verses 27 through 29. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. We may be as religious as our fathers, but we are certainly less credulous. With the best will in the world, we cannot imagine an omnipotent, ubiquitous, infinitely good God who is above all concepts of time and yet does not know what is going to happen. God created man and was satisfied with his work. However, he seems to have repented of his deed later, because this same creator decided to destroy mankind. It is also difficult for enlightened children of this age to think of an infinitely good father who gives preference to favorite children, such as Lot's family, over countless others. The Old Testament gives some impressive descriptions in which God alone or his angels fly straight down from heaven, making a tremendous noise and issuing clouds of smoke. One of the most original descriptions of such incidents comes to us from the prophet Ezekiel, Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar, that the heavens were opened. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it. And out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of 4 living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had 4 faces, and every one had 4 wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Ezekiel gives precise details of the landing of this vehicle. He describes a craft that comes from the north, emitting rays and gleaming and raising a gigantic cloud of desert sand. Now, the God of the Old Testament was supposed to be omnipotent. Then why does this Almighty God have to come hurtling up from a particular direction? Cannot he be anywhere he wants, without all this noise and fuss? Let us follow Ezekiel's eyewitness account a little further. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures, with his 4 faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a barrel, and they 4 had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went upon their 4 sides, and they turned not as they went. As for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them 4. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them, and when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. The description is astonishingly good. Ezekiel says each wheel was in the middle of another one, an optical illusion. To our present way of thinking, what he saw was one of those special vehicles the Americans use in the desert and swampy terrain. Ezekiel observed that the wheels rose from the ground simultaneously with the winged creatures. He was quite right. Naturally, the wheels of a multipurpose vehicle, say an amphibious helicopter, do not stay on the ground when it takes off. More from Ezekiel. Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. The narrator heard this voice and hid his face in the ground in fear and trembling. The strange apparitions addressed Ezekiel as son of man and wanted to talk to him. The account goes on. And I heard behind me a voice of a great rushing, saying, Blessed be the glory of the Lord from his place. I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and a noise of a great rushing. In addition to his precise description of the vehicle, Ezekiel also noted the noise the novel monstrosity made when it left the ground. He likens the din made by the wings and the wheels to a great rushing. Surely this suggests that this is an eyewitness account. The gods spoke to Ezekiel and told him that it was his task to restore law and order to the country. They took him with them in their vehicle and confirmed that they had not yet forsaken the country. This experience made a strong impression on Ezekiel, for he never tires of describing the weird vehicle. On 3 more occasions he says that each wheel was in the middle of a wheel, and that the 4 wheels could go on their 4 sides, and turned not as they went. And he was particularly impressed by the fact that the whole body of the vehicle, the backs, the hands, the wings, and even the wheels, were full of eyes. The gods reveal the purpose and goal of their journey to the chronicler later when they tell him that he is living in the midst of a rebellious house, which has eyes to see and sees not, ears to hear and hears not. Once he has been enlightened about his countrymen, there follow, as in all descriptions of such landings, advice and directions for law and order, as well as hints for creating a proper civilization. Ezekiel took the task very seriously and handed on the instructions of the gods. Once again, we are confronted with all kinds of questions. Who spoke to Ezekiel? What sort of beings were they? They were certainly not gods in the traditional sense of the word, or they would not have needed a vehicle to move from one place to another. This kind of locomotion seems to me to be quite incompatible with the idea of an almighty God. In this connection, there is another technical invention in the Book of Books, which is worthwhile examining impartially. In Exodus chapter 15, verse 10, Moses relates the exact instructions which God gave for building the Ark of the Covenant. The directions are given to the very inch, how and where staves and rings are to be fitted, and from what alloy the metals are to be made. The instructions were meant to ensure that everything was carried out exactly as God wanted it. He warned Moses several times not to make any mistakes. "And look that thou make them after their pattern, which was shewed thee in the mount." Exodus chapter 25, verse 40. God also told Moses that he would speak to him from the mercy seat. No one, he told Moses, should come close to the Ark of the Covenant. And he gave precise instructions about the clothing to be worn and the footwear appropriate when transporting it. In spite of all this care, there was a slip-up. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 2. David had the Ark of the Covenant moved, and Uzzah helped to drive the cart it was in. When passing cattle shook and threatened to overturn the Ark, Uzzah grabbed hold of it. He fell dead on the spot, as if struck by lightning. Undoubtedly, the Ark was electrically charged. If we reconstruct it today according to the instructions handed down by Moses, an electric conductor of several hundred volts is produced. The border and golden crown would have served to charge the condenser, which was formed by the gold plates, and a positive and negative conductor. If, in addition, one of the two cherubim on the mercy seat acted as a magnet, the loudspeaker, perhaps even a kind of set for communication between Moses and the spaceship, was perfect. The details of the construction of the Ark of the Covenant can be read in the Bible in their entirety. Without actually consulting Exodus, I seem to remember that the Ark was often surrounded by flashing sparks, and that Moses made use of this transmitter whenever he needed help and advice. Moses heard the voice of his Lord, but he never saw him face to face. When he asked him to show himself to him on one occasion, his God answered, "Thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock. And it shall come to pass, while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in a clift of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away mine hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen." Exodus chapter 33, verses 20 through 23. There are some astonishing similarities in old texts. On the fifth tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is of Sumerian origin and much older than the Bible, we find virtually the same sentence. "No mortal comes to the mountain where the gods dwell. He who looks the gods in the face must die." In other ancient books, which hand down stages in the history of mankind, we find very similar statements. Why did the gods not want to show themselves face to face? Why did they not let their masks fall? What were they afraid of? Or does the whole account in Exodus come from the Epic of Gilgamesh? Even that is possible. After all, Moses is supposed to have been brought up in the Egyptian royal household. Perhaps he had access to the library or acquired knowledge of ancient secrets during those years. Perhaps we ought to query our Old Testament dating, too, because there is a good deal to support the fact that David, who lived much later, fought with a giant with six fingers and six toes in his day. 2 Samuel chapter 21, verses 18 through 22. We must also consider the possibility that all the ancient histories, sagas, and narratives were collected and compiled in one spot, and later found their way to different countries in the form of copies and somewhat garbled versions. The finds during recent years near the Dead Sea, the Qumran texts, provide a valuable and astonishing amplification of the biblical book of Genesis. Once again, several hitherto unknown texts mention heavenly chariots, sons of heaven, wheels, and the smoke which the flying apparitions emitted. In the Moses Apocalypse, chapter 33, Eve looked up to heaven and saw a chariot of light traveling there. It was drawn by four shining eagles. No terrestrial being could have described its magnificence, it says in Moses. Finally, the chariot drove up to Adam, and smoke came out from between the wheels. This story, incidentally, does not tell as much that is new. Nevertheless, Chariots of light, wheels, and smoke were spoken of as magnificent apparitions as early as and in connection with Adam and Eve. A fantastic event was deciphered in the Lamech scroll. As the scroll is only fragmentarily preserved, sentences and whole paragraphs of the text are missing. However, what remains is curious enough to be worth retelling. This tradition says that one fine day, Lamech, Noah's father, came home and was surprised to find a boy who, judging by his appearance, was quite out of place in the family. Lamech reproached his wife, Bat-Enosh, and claimed that the child was not his. Then Bat-Enosh swore by all that was holy that the seed came from him, Father Lamech, and not from a soldier or a stranger or one of the sons of heaven. In parenthesis, we may ask, what sort of sons of heaven was Bat-Enosh talking about? At all event, this family drama took place before the flood. Nevertheless, Lamech did not believe his wife's protestations and, feeling very upset, went to ask his father Methuselah for advice. On his arrival, he related the family story that was so depressing to him. Methuselah listened to it, reflected, and went off himself to consult the wise Enoch. The cuckoo in the family nest was causing so much trouble that the old man accepted the hardships of the long journey. The question of the little boy's origin had to be cleared up. So Methuselah described how a boy had appeared in his son's family who looked much more like a son of heaven than a man. His eyes, hair, skin, and whole being were unlike those of the rest of the family. Enoch listened to the story and sent old Methuselah on his way with the extremely worrying news that a great judgment would come upon the earth and mankind, and that all flesh would be destroyed because it was sordid and dissolute. But the strange boy of whom the family was suspicious had been chosen as the progenitor of those who should survive the great universal judgment. Therefore he should order his son Lamech to call the child Noah. Methuselah journeyed home and told his son Lamech what was in store for them all. What could Lamech do but recognize the unusual child as his own and give him the name of Noah? The astonishing thing about this family story is the information that Noah's parents were told about the coming flood, and that even Grandfather Methuselah was forewarned of the terrible event by the same Enoch who soon afterward, according to tradition, disappeared forever in a fiery heavenly chariot. Does not this seriously pose the question whether the human race is not an act of deliberate breeding by unknown beings from outer space? Otherwise, what can be the sense of the constantly recurring fertilization of human beings by giants and sons of heaven, with the consequent extermination of unsuccessful specimens? Seen in this light, the flood becomes a preconceived project by unknown beings with the intention of exterminating the human race, except for a few noble exceptions. But if the flood, the course of which is historically proved, was quite deliberately planned and prepared, and that several hundred years before Noah received orders to build the ark, then it can no longer be accepted as a divine judgment. Today the possibility of breeding an intelligent human race is no longer such an absurd theory. Just as the sagas of Tiwanaku and the inscription of the pediment of the Gate of the Sun talk about a spaceship which landed the Great Mother on Earth so that she could bear children, the old religious scripts, too, never tire of saying that God created men in his own image. There are texts which note that it needed several experiments before man finally turned out as successfully as God wanted. With the theory of a visit to our Earth by unknown intelligences from the cosmos, we could postulate that today we are similarly constituted to those fabulous unidentified beings. In this chain of evidence, the offerings for which the gods asked our ancestors raise curious problems. Their demands were by no means limited to incense and animal sacrifices. The lists of gifts required by the gods often include coins made of alloys which are specified in great detail. In fact, the biggest smelting installations in the ancient East were found at Ezion-Geber, consisting of a regular ultra-modern furnace with a system of air channels, chimney flues, and openings for specific purposes. Smelting experts of our own day are confronted with the as-yet-unexplained phenomenon of how copper could have been refined in this prehistoric installation. That was undoubtedly the case, for large deposits of copper sulfate were found in the caves and galleries around Ezion-Geber. All these finds are estimated to be at least 5,000 years old. If our own space travelers happen to meet primitive peoples on a planet one day, they too will presumably seem like sons of heaven or gods to them. Perhaps our intelligences will be as far ahead of the inhabitants of these unknown and as yet unimagined regions as those fabulous apparitions from the universe were ahead of our primitive ancestors. But what a disappointment if time on this as yet unknown landing place had also been progressing, and our astronauts were not greeted as gods, but laughed at as beings living far behind the times. Chapter 5 Fiery Chariots from the Heavens. A sensational find was made in the hill of Kunyanchik around the turn of the century. It was a heroic epic of great expressive power engraved on 12 clay tablets, and it belonged to the library of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal. The epic was written in Akkadian. Later, a second copy was found that goes back to King Hammurabi. It is an established fact that the original version of the Epic of Gilgamesh stems from the Sumerians, that mysterious people whose origin we do not know, but who left behind the astonishing 15-digit number and a very advanced astronomy. It is also clear that the main thread of the Epic of Gilgamesh runs parallel to the biblical book of Genesis. The first clay tablet of the Kunyanchik finds relates that the victorious hero Gilgamesh built the wall around Uruk. We read that the god of heaven lived in a stately home which contained granaries, and that guards stood on the town walls. We learn that Gilgamesh was a mixture of god and man, two-thirds god, one-third man. Pilgrims who came to Uruk gazed up at him in fear and trembling because they had never seen his like for beauty and strength. In other words, the beginning of the narrative contains the idea of interbreeding between god and man yet again. The second tablet tells us that another figure, Enkidu, was created by the goddess of heaven, Aruru. Enkidu is described in great detail. His whole body was covered with hair. He wore skins, ate grass in the fields, and drank at the same watering place as the cattle. He also disported himself in the tumbling waters. When Gilgamesh, the king of the town of Uruk, heard about this unattractive creature, he suggested that he should be given a lovely woman, so that he would become estranged from the cattle. Enkidu, innocent fellow, was taken in by the king's trick, and spent 6 days and 6 nights with a semi-divine beauty. This little bit of royal pandering leads us to think that the idea of cross-breeding between a demigod and a half-animal was not taken quite as a matter of course in this barbaric world. The third tablet goes on to tell us about a cloud of dust which came from the distance. The heavens roared, the earth quaked, and finally the sun god came and seized Enkidu with mighty wings and claws. We read in astonishment that he lay like lead on Enkidu's body, and that the weight of his body seemed to him like the weight of a boulder. Even if we grant the old storytellers a fertile imagination, and discount the additions made by translators and copyists, the incredible thing about the account still remains. How on earth could the old chroniclers have known that the weight of the body becomes as heavy as lead at a certain acceleration? Nowadays we know all about the forces of gravity and acceleration. When an astronaut is pressed back into his seat by a force of several G's at takeoff, it has all been calculated in advance. But how on earth did this idea occur to the old chroniclers? The fifth tablet narrates how Gilgamesh and Enkidu set out to visit the abode of the gods together. The tower in which the goddess Erninis lived could be seen gleaming in the distance long before they reached it. The arrows and missiles which the cautious wanderers rained on the guards rebounded harmlessly. And as they reached the precinct of the gods, a voice roared at them, "Turn back! No mortal comes to the holy mountain where the gods dwell. He who looks the gods in the face must die. Thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live," it says in Exodus. On the seventh tablet is the first eyewitness account of a space trip told by Enkidu. He flew for 4 hours held in the brazen talons of an eagle. This is how his story goes, literally. "He said to me, 'Look down at the land. What does it look like? Look at the sea. How does it seem to you? And the land was like a mountain, and the sea was like a lake. And again he flew for 4 hours and said to me, Look down at the land. What does it look like? Look at the sea. How does it seem to you? And the earth was like a garden, and the sea like the water channel of a gardener. And he flew higher yet another 4 hours and spake, Look down at the land. What does it look like? Look at the sea. How does it seem to you? And the land looked like porridge, and the sea like a water trough. In this case, some living creature must have seen the earth from a great height. The account is too accurate to have been the product of pure imagination. Who could have possibly said that the land looked like porridge and the sea like a water trough if some conception of the globe from above had not existed? Because the earth actually does look like a jigsaw puzzle of porridge and water troughs from a great height. When the same tablet tells us that a door spoke like a living person, we unhesitatingly identify this strange phenomenon as a loudspeaker. And on the eighth tablet, this same Enkidu, who must have seen the earth from a considerable height, dies of a mysterious disease, so mysterious that Gilgamesh asks whether he may not have been smitten by the poisonous breath of a heavenly beast. But where did Gilgamesh get the idea that the poisonous breath of a heavenly beast could cause a fatal and incurable disease? The ninth tablet describes how Gilgamesh mourns for the death of his friend Enkidu and decides to undertake a long journey to the gods because he is obsessed by the idea that he might die of the same disease as Enkidu. The narrative says that Gilgamesh came to two mountains which supported the heavens, and that these two mountains arched the gate of the sun. At the gate of the sun he met two giants, and after a lengthy discussion they let him pass because he was two-thirds god himself. Finally Gilgamesh found the garden of the gods, beyond which stretched the endless sea. While Gilgamesh was on his way, the gods warned him twice, Gilgamesh, whither art thou hurrying? Thou shalt not find the life that thou seekest. When the gods created man, they allotted him to death, but life they retained in their own keeping. Gilgamesh would not be warned. He wanted to reach Utnapishtim, the father of men, no matter what the dangers. But Utnapishtim lived on the far side of the great sea. No road led to him, and no ship flew across it except the sun gods. Braving all kinds of perils, Gilgamesh crossed the sea. Then follows his encounter with Utnapishtim, which is described in the 11th tablet. Gilgamesh found the figure of the father of men neither bigger nor broader than his own, and he said that they resembled each other like father and son. Then Utnapishtim tells Gilgamesh about his past, strangely enough, in the first person. To our amazement, we are given a detailed description of the flood. He recounts that the gods warned him of the great flood to come and gave him the task of building a boat on which he was to shelter women and children, his relatives, and craftsmen of every kind. The description of the violent storm, the darkness, the rising flood, and the despair of the people he could not take with him has tremendous narrative power even today. We also hear, just as in Noah's account in the Bible, the story of the raven and the dove that were released and how finally, as the waters went down, the boat grounded on a mountain. The parallel between the stories of the flood in the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Bible is beyond doubt, and there is not a single scholar who contests it. The fascinating thing about this parallelism is that we are dealing with different omens and different gods in this case. If the account of the flood in the Bible is a second-hand one, the first-person form of Utnapishtim's narrative shows that a survivor, an eyewitness, was speaking in the Epic of Gilgamesh. It has been clearly proved that a catastrophic flood did take place in the ancient East some thousands of years ago. Ancient Babylonian cuneiform texts indicate very precisely where the remains of the boat ought to be. And on the south side of Mount Ararat, investigators did in fact find three pieces of wood which possibly indicate the place where the ark grounded. Incidentally, the chances of finding the remains of a ship that was mainly built of wood and survived a flood more than 6,000 years ago are extremely remote. Besides being a first-hand report, the Epic of Gilgamesh also contains descriptions of extraordinary things that could not have been made up by any intelligence living at the time the tablets were written, any more than they could have been devised by the translators and copyists who manhandled the epic over the centuries. For there are facts buried among the descriptions that must have been known to the author of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and we may discover them if we look in the light of present-day knowledge. Perhaps asking some new questions may throw a little light on the darkness. Is it possible that the Epic of Gilgamesh did not originate in the ancient East at all, but in the Tiahuanaco region? Is it conceivable that descendants of Gilgamesh came from South America and brought the epic with them? An affirmative answer would at least explain the mention of the Gate of the Sun, the crossing of the sea, and at the same time, the sudden appearance of the Sumerians, for as is well known, all the creations of Babylon which came later go back to the Sumerians. Undoubtedly, the advanced Egyptian culture of the pharaohs possessed libraries in which the old secrets were preserved, taught, learned, and written down. As has already been mentioned, Moses grew up at the Egyptian court, and certainly had access to the venerable library rooms. Moses was a receptive and learned man. Indeed, he is supposed to have written 5 of his books himself, although it is still an unsolved puzzle in what language he could have written them. If we work on the hypothesis that the Epic of Gilgamesh came to Egypt from the Sumerians by way of the Assyrians and Babylonians, and that the young Moses found it there and adapted it for his own ends, then the Sumerian story of the flood, and not the biblical one, would be the genuine account. Ought we not to ask such questions? The classical method of research into antiquity has got bogged down and so cannot come to the right unassailable kind of conclusions. It is far too attached to its stereotyped pattern of thought and leaves no scope for the imaginative ideas and speculations which alone could produce a creative impulse. Many opportunities for research into the ancient East, undoubtedly founded on the inviolability and sacredness of the Bible. People did not dare to ask questions and voice their doubts aloud in the face of this taboo. Even the scholars of the 19th and 20th centuries, ostensibly so enlightened, were still caught in the mental fetters of thousand-year-old errors, because the way back would inevitably have called in question parts of the biblical story. But even very religious Christians must have realized that many of the events described in the Old Testament cannot really be reconciled with the character of a good, great, and omnipresent God. The very man who wants to preserve the religious dogmas of the Bible intact ought to be interested in clarifying who actually educated men in antiquity, who gave them the first rules for a communal life, who handed down the first laws of hygiene, and who annihilated the degenerate stock. If we think in this way and ask questions like this, it need not mean that we are irreligious. I myself am quite convinced that when the last question about our past has been given a genuine and convincing answer, something which I call God, for want of a better name, will remain for eternity. Yet the hypothesis that the unimaginable God needed vehicles with wheels and wings to move from place to place, mated with primitive people, and dared not let his mask fall remains an outrageous piece of presumption, as long as it is unsupported by proof. The theologians answer that God is wise and that we cannot imagine in what way he shows himself and makes his people humble is really dodging our question and is unsatisfactory for that reason. People would like to close their eyes to new realities, too. But the future gnaws away at our past day after day. In the near future, the first men will land on Mars. If there is a single ancient, long-abandoned edifice there, if there is a single object indicating earlier intelligences, if there is one still recognizable rock drawing to be found, then these finds will shake the foundations of our religions and throw our past into confusion. One single discovery of this kind will cause the greatest revolution and reformation in the history of mankind. In view of the inevitable confrontation with the future, would it not be more intelligent to use new imaginative ideas when conjuring up our past? Without being unbelieving, we could no longer afford to be credulous. Every religion has an outline, a schema of its God. It is constrained to think and believe within the framework of this outline. Meanwhile, with the space age, the intellectual day of judgment comes ever nearer. The theological clouds will evaporate, scattered like shreds of mist. With the decisive step into the universe, we shall have to recognize that there are not 2 million gods, not 20,000 sects, not 10 great religions, but only one. But let us continue to build onto our hypothesis of the utopian past of humanity. This is the picture so far. Dim, as yet undefinable ages ago, an unknown spaceship discovered our planet. The crew of the spaceship soon found out that the Earth had all the prerequisites for intelligent life to develop. Obviously, the man of those times was no Homo sapiens, but something rather different. The spacemen artificially fertilized some female members of this species, put them into a deep sleep, so ancient legends say, and departed. Thousands of years later, the space travelers returned and found scattered specimens of the genus Homo sapiens. They repeated their breeding experiment several times until finally they produced a creature intelligent enough to have the rules of society imparted to it. The people of that age were still barbaric, because there was a danger that they might retrogress and mate with animals again. The space travelers destroyed the unsuccessful specimens, or took them with them to settle them on other continents. The first communities and the first skills came into being. Rock faces and cave walls were painted, pottery was discovered, and the first attempts at architecture were made. These first men had tremendous respect for the space travelers. Because they came from somewhere absolutely unknown and then returned there again, they were the gods to them. For some mysterious reason, the gods were interested in passing on their intelligence. They took care of the creatures they bred. They wanted to protect them from corruption and preserve them from evil. They wanted to ensure that their community developed constructively. They wiped out the freaks and saw to it that the remainder received the basic requirements for a society capable of development. Admittedly, this speculation is still full of holes. I shall be told that proofs are lacking. The future will show how many of these holes can be filled in. This book puts forward a hypothesis made up of many speculations, therefore the hypothesis must not be true. Yet when I compare it with the theories enabling many religions to live unassailed in the shelter of their taboos, I should like to attribute a minimal percentage of probability to my hypothesis. Perhaps it will do some good to say a few words about the truth. Anyone who believes in a religion and has never been under attack is convinced that he has the truth. That applies not only to Christians, but also to the members of other religious communities, both large and small. Theosophists, theologists, and philosophers have reflected about their teaching, about their master and his teaching. They are convinced that they have found the truth. Naturally, every religion has its history, its promises made by God, its covenants with God, its prophets and wise teachers who have said, "Proofs of the truth always start from the center of one's own religion and work outward." The result is a biased way of thinking which we are brought up to accept from childhood. Nevertheless, generations lived and still do live in the conviction that they possess the truth. Somewhat more modestly, I claim that we cannot possess the truth. At best, we can believe in it. Anyone who really seeks the truth cannot and ought not to seek it under the aegis and within the confines of his own religion. If he does so, is not insincerity godfather to a matter which demands the greatest integrity? What is the purpose and goal of life, after all? To believe in the truth or to seek it? Even if Old Testament facts can be proved archaeologically in Mesopotamia, those verified facts are still no proof of the religion concerned. If ancient cities, villages, wells, and inscriptions are dug up in a particular area, the finds show that the history of the people who lived there is an actual fact, but they do not prove that the god of that people was the one and only god, and not a space traveler. Today, excavations all over the world show that traditions tally with the facts. But would it occur to a single Christian to recognize the god of the pre-Inca culture as the genuine god as the results of excavations in Peru? Quite simply, what I mean is that everything, both myth and actual experience, makes up the history of a people. No more. But even that, I claim, is quite a lot. So anyone who really seeks truth cannot ignore new and bold and as yet unproved points of view simply because they do not fit into his scheme of thought or belief. Since the question of space travel did not arise 100 years ago, our fathers and grandfathers could not reasonably have had thoughts about whether our ancestors had visits from the universe. Let us just venture the frightful but unfortunately possible idea that our present-day civilization was entirely destroyed in an H-bomb war. 5,000 years later, archaeologists would find fragments of the Statue of Liberty in New York. According to our current way of thinking, they would be bound to assert that they were dealing with an unknown divinity, probably a fire god because of the torch, or a sun god because of the rays around the statue's head. They would never dare to say that it was a perfectly simple artifact, namely a Statue of Liberty. It is no longer possible to block the roads to the past with dogmas. If we want to set out on the arduous search for the truth, we must all summon up the courage to leave the lines along which we have thought until now, and as the first step, begin to doubt everything that we previously accepted as correct and true. Can we still afford to close our eyes and stop up our ears because new ideas are supposed to be heretical and absurd? After all, the idea of landing on the moon was absurd 50 years ago. Chapter 6. Ancient Imagination and Legends, or Ancient Facts. As I have previously observed, there were things in antiquity that should not have existed according to current ideas. But my collector's zeal is by no means exhausted with the finds already accumulated. Why? Because the mythology of the Eskimos also says that the first tribes were brought to the north by gods with brazen wings. The oldest American Indian sagas mention a thunderbird who introduced fire and fruit to them. The Mayan legend, the Popol Vuh, tells us that the gods were able to recognize everything, the universe, the four cardinal points of the compass, and even the round shape of the earth. What are the Eskimos doing talking about metal birds? Why do the Indians mention a thunderbird? How are the ancestors of the Mayas supposed to have known that the earth is round? The Mayas were intelligent. They had a highly developed culture. They left behind not only a fabulous calendar, but also incredible calculations. They knew the Venusian year of 584 days and estimated the duration of the terrestrial year at 365.2420 days. The exact calculation today, 365.2422. The Mayas left behind them calculations to last for 64 million years. Later inscriptions dealt in units which probably approach 400 million years. The famous Venusian formula could quite plausibly have been calculated by an electronic brain. At any rate, it is difficult to believe that it originated from a jungle people. The Venusian formula of the Mayas runs as follows. The Zulcan has 260 days, the terrestrial year 365 days, and the Venusian year 584 days. These figures conceal the possibility of an astonishing division sum. 365 is divisible by 73 five times, and 584 eight times. So the incredible formula takes this form. Moon, 20 times 13 equals 260 times 2 times 73 equals 37,960. Sun, 8 times 13 equals 104 times 5 times 73 equals 37,960. Venus, 5 times 13 equals 65 times 8 times 73 equals 37,960. In other words, all the cycles coincide after 37,960 days. Mayan mythology claimed that then the gods would come to the great resting place. The religious legends of the pre-Inca peoples say that the stars were inhabited, and that the gods came down to them from the constellation of the Pleiades. Sumerian, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Egyptian cuneiform inscriptions constantly present the same picture. Gods came from the stars and went back to them. They traveled through the heavens in fireships or boats, possessed terrifying weapons, and promised immortality to individual men. It was, of course, perfectly natural for the ancient peoples to seek their gods in the sky and also to give their imagination full rein when describing the magnificence of these incomprehensible apparitions. Yet even if all that is accepted, there are still too many anomalies left. For example, how did the chronicler of the Mahabharata know that a weapon capable of punishing a country with a 12 years drought could exist, and powerful enough to kill the unborn in their mother's wombs? This ancient Indian epic, the Mahabharata, is more comprehensive than the Bible, and even at a conservative estimate, its original core is at least 5,000 years old. It is well worth reading this epic in the light of present-day knowledge. We shall not be very surprised when we learn in the Ramayana that Vimanas, that is, flying machines, navigated at great heights with the aid of quicksilver and a great propulsive wind. The Vimanas could cover vast distances and could travel forward, upward, and downward. Enviably maneuverable space vehicles. This quotation comes from the translation by N. Dutt, 1891. At Rama's behest, the magnificent chariot rose up to a mountain of cloud with a tremendous din. We cannot help noticing that not only is a flying object mentioned again, but also that the chronicler talks of a tremendous din. Here is another passage from the Mahabharata. Bhima flew with his Vimana on an enormous ray, which was as brilliant as the sun, and made a noise like the thunder of a storm. C. Roy, 1889. Even imagination needs something to start it off. How can the chronicler give descriptions that presuppose at least some idea of rockets and the knowledge that such a vehicle can ride on a ray and cause a terrifying thunder? In the Samsaptakabada, a distinction is made between chariots that fly and those that cannot fly. The first book of the Mahabharata reveals the intimate history of the unmarried Kunti, who not only received a visit from the sun god, but also had a son by him, a son who was supposed to have been as radiant as the sun itself. As Kunti was afraid, even in those days, of falling into disgrace, she laid the child in a little basket and put it in a river. Adirata, a worthy man of the Sutta caste, fished basket and child out of the water and brought up the infant. Really a story that is hardly worth mentioning if it were not so remarkably like the story of Moses. And, of course, there is yet another reference to the fertilization of humans by gods. Like Gilgamesh, Aryuna, the hero of the Mahabharata, undertakes a long journey in order to seek the gods and ask them for weapons. And when Aryuna has found the gods after many perils, Indra, the Lord of Heaven, with his wife Sachi beside him, grants him a very exclusive audience. The two do not meet the valiant Aryuna just anywhere. They meet him in a heavenly war chariot, and even invite him to travel in the sky with them. Certain numerical data in the Mahabharata are so precise that one gets the impression that the author was writing from first-hand knowledge. Full of repulsion, he describes a weapon that could kill all warriors who wore metal on their bodies. If the warriors learned about the effect of this weapon in time, they tore off all the metal equipment they were wearing, jumped into a river and washed themselves and everything that they had come into contact with very thoroughly. Not without reason, as the author explains, for the weapon made the hair and nails fall out. Everything living, he bemoaned, became pale and weak. In the eighth book, we meet Indra in his heavenly jet chariot again. Out of the whole of mankind, he has chosen Yudhisthira as the only one who may enter heaven in his mortal frame. Here, too, the parallel with the stories of Enoch and Elijah cannot be overlooked. In the same book, in what is perhaps the first account of the dropping of an H-bomb, it says that Gurkha loosed a single projectile on the Triple City from a mighty Vimana. The narrative uses words which linger in our memories from eyewitness accounts of the detonation of the first hydrogen bomb at Bikini. White-hot smoke, 1,000 times brighter than the sun, rose up in infinite brilliance and reduced the city to ashes. When Gurkha landed again, his vehicle was like a flashing block of antimony. And for the benefit of the philosophers, I should mention that the Mahabharata says that time is the seed of the universe. The Tibetan books, Tantiyuwa and Kantiyuwa, also mention prehistoric flying machines, which they call pearls in the sky. Both books expressly emphasize that this knowledge is secret and not for the masses. In the Samarangana Sutradhara, whole chapters are devoted to describing airships whose tails spout fire and quicksilver. The word fire in ancient texts cannot mean burning fire, for altogether some 40 different kinds of fire, mainly connected with esoteric and magnetic phenomena, are enumerated. It is hard to believe that the ancient peoples should have known that it is possible to gain energy from heavy metals and how to do so. However, we should not oversimplify and dismiss the old Sanskrit texts as mere myths. The large number of passages from old texts already quoted turns the suspicion that men encountered flying gods in antiquity almost into a certainty. We are not going to get any further with the old approach which scholars unfortunately still cling to. That doesn't exist.